Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dell.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And how things change. In March, Mitt Romney made one of the most emphatic cases against Donald Trump of the entire year.
This recklessness is recklessness in the extreme. Now, Donald Trump tells us that he is very, very smart. I'm afraid that when it comes to foreign policy, he is very, very not smart.
And here's now President-elect Trump back in April.
The last election should have been won, except Romney choked like a dog. He choked. He went, "I can't breathe."
But in one of the crazier twists of Donald Trump's transition period, and remember, this includes the president-elect tweeting out about Broadway plays and Saturday Night Live, Mitt Romney is now apparently under very serious consideration for Secretary of State. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here with some thoughts about that and other news. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
And what are we hearing now in terms of Romney's chances? Because last week people were saying, no, that's not possible. And does he appear to want the post now?
He does appear to want to at least make some sort of peace with Donald Trump after that exchange and many others like it that you just cited. He does appear to want to be on the team. He could certainly stay in his own world. He does not absolutely have to be in Washington. He's not a senator. He's not someone who has to deal with the president. So he was willing to come and submit to this Bedminster, New Jersey version of the White House that looks a little bit like an entrance to the White House but is actually one of Donald Trump's golf clubs. And he was willing to submit to that whole business. There was kind of a bemused look on his face or an amused look on his face as he came out, and a lot of kind of funny pictures of the two posing together. Obviously, that was one of the things Saturday Night Live made fun of. So it's real hard to see them as a foreign policy team when Mitt Romney said back in 2012 that our biggest world problem was the aggressive Russians. And Donald Trump has very recently continued to say that we should be friends with the Russians.
Yeah. Well, Donald Trump also met with and raved about General James Mattis, the retired Marine Corps general, in the front running, I guess, for defense secretary. Can you tell us a little more about Mattis?
Strong current running in favor of General James Mattis today. When Donald Trump tweeted about him over the weekend, he referred to him as General Jim, quote, Mad Dog, unquote, Mattis. Mad Dog Mattis. Now, that's been a nickname that he's had in his 44-year career in the United States Marines. He led one of the combat divisions in Iraq, when we invaded that country in 2003. He has also had some other really tough missions as a Marine general, and he is seen as a tough and aggressive general, but he is also a person of a remarkable degree of education. He has also been seen as an intellect in the military, and so he would probably be one of the stronger members of the team if a team is really what Donald Trump is trying to put together with respect to national security.
Yeah. Well, Ron, you mentioned, you know, Donald Trump was tweeting out over the weekend about some of the candidates. You've seen a few of these transitions. This one is like a reality show. How unusual is this, and how maybe, you know, fraught with future problems? What if, you know, we see these people go in and do the handshakes on the front porch? What if Donald Trump offers a position to someone and they turn it down? I mean, normally this is kind of behind closed doors.
One would not expect that anyone willing to go and be part of this sort of audition, as you say, one is tempted to remember Celebrity Apprentice. If someone is willing to go be part of Donald Trump's reality show, would they then turn down the offer of a position if it were the position they had been interviewing for? That seems unlikely. Mm. The time to say no might very well be before you go on stage with Donald Trump.
Yeah. But and have you ever seen anything like this?
No. But okay. Then on the other hand, everything about the Donald Trump presidential bid has been brand new. It's been Donald Trump's rules, not the normal rules. And I think we should probably get used to this because there's no reason to think he's going to change.
Okay. Well, in the same vein, Donald Trump's been very active again on Twitter, tweeting several times over the weekend in a back and forth with Alec Baldwin, who played him on SNL. Trump asked for equal time. Of course, you know, any president who wants to on SNL, I'm sure, could walk right in. He also attacked the cast of Hamilton after they appealed directly to Vice President-elect Mike Pence, who was in the audience, asking him to protect diversity. They made a statement. Most people have heard about this by now. We know Donald Trump elected with overwhelming white votes. Do you see this changing? Do you see him doing something to maybe? I mean, Mike Pence said, you know, I thought it was lovely that we had this, you know, exchange. He was more political. You know, he is a politician, but people do have freedom of speech. So, how do you see Donald Trump handling this Twitter handle as we go forward?
I imagine there are going to be many more days when Donald Trump sends something out on his Twitter handle and Mike Pence or somebody else kind of walks it back a little bit. And then Donald Trump goes back and either deletes the tweet or says something else, goes in some other direction. Let's remember that Donald Trump himself personally has been the host of Saturday Night Live. He has been a guest on Saturday Night Live. He has had no problem with it at other points in history when it served his general overall show business purpose. Yeah. And he has done quite well with that approach to politics and that approach to show business. One would expect that he would be a highly unusual president in this regard and be much, much more visible in the entertainment media than any president we've had before.
We also should note that there's a traveling company of Hamilton in Chicago, and apparently an audience member got up during a program after the cast in New York made their appeal and got up during a show and shouted epithets at the actors on stage. So this could get into more dangerous territory. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, on Election Day in Nashville, Tennessee, two neighbors ran into each other outside their polling place. The neighbors were friends, common enough story, but one was a newly minted American citizen, and they found out on November 8th that they were supporting different presidential candidates. Maraba Knight from Here and Now contributor WPLN was outside that polling place on Election Day and went to see what, if anything, has changed between these two friends.
Jaime Rodriguez was clutching his citizenship papers, giddy about voting in his first U.S. election, when he ran into his neighbor, Linda Fannerstill, on Election Day. But then Jaime discovered, in front of my microphone, that after 20 years of friendship, the two had diverged in the polling booth.
No, maybe. Me, I like Hillary Clinton.
And you see, I voted for Donald Trump.
Because you voted for Donald Trump?
Absolutely.
Sweetie, Donald Trump don't like Mexicans. When they bring everybody to Mexico, is the problem. Everybody's scared.
No, that's not quite true. No.
I caught up with Linda again last week. She was sitting at her tidy kitchen table, still digesting America's seismic political shift.
I didn't expect him to win. And I saw that electoral board on the screen and how red it was. And I thought, this was a movement.
Linda considers herself an independent. She voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And in 2012, she went independent. Like so many others, she complains of jobs lost overseas and gridlock in Washington. In the midst of her excitement over Trump's victory, though, she thought of Jaime, his wife Lourdes, and their four children, who emigrated from Mexico decades earlier.
I hope that he wasn't too sad. I hope he wasn't afraid, because I had no concern that what he was talking about was going to happen to him or his family.
Next door, Jaime is getting ready to leave for work at the Mexican restaurant he owns. He talks about what went through his mind when he awoke to find out Trump had won.
I don't feel no good because everybody wanted Hillary Clinton and don't win. And everybody said, oh man, I don't know why Trump is the new president.
Despite Trump's controversial comments about deporting millions of undocumented immigrants, Jaime knew his immediate family wasn't at risk. His four kids are in college and all have residency or citizenship here. But he did worry about his extended family. His son Jose explains.
We actually have a lot of family that's undocumented. There's only like a handful that are.
Jaime wonders aloud what might happen to his undocumented family members under a Trump presidency.
Many people got houses and no legals and they're scared because say maybe one day go to my door like you and scared, oh man, you swear your papers, I don't have, sent to Mexico and lose your money and your jobs and everything. It's just, everybody is just scared.
There was another rift before Trump came between these friends. When Jaime and his family moved to the neighborhood in the mid-90s, he recalls a chilly reception.
Linda told me when the first time we buy the home here, everybody looked like me like, no way, Jose.
Linda, though, remembers the arrival differently.
I was a mom. I see these four little tykes out there playing, and I'm going, what a bunch of cute kids. I fell in love with them immediately. Then I thought, my gosh. I don't know that family. I don't care, you know, what they are. They could have been Muslims, for all I knew. They could have been anything. Because of that, it just broke down all the other barriers.
All these years later, the families have become the kind of neighbors that look after each other, offer rides to the doctor, and trade gifts on special occasions. And while Jaime worries about loved ones without immigration papers, Linda can't conceive that her neighbors might be part of what Trump says is hurting America.
I know that it's the criminal element that is really causing the problem. I really know that. It's not the good people that are here working and trying to feed their families. It's not them.
But Jaime Rodriguez knows that for many hardworking immigrants, being undocumented can be part of the journey. He says even he came to this country illegally before an employer sponsored his residency. Still, he told me he's taking what Hillary Clinton said to heart, trying to keep an open mind and give President-elect Trump a chance. For Here and Now, I'm Maribel Knight in Nashville.
The price of oil rallied today after Russian President Vladimir Putin said he's ready to freeze or cap oil production. Any bump in oil is good news to many North Dakotans. About 2 years ago, I spoke with Howard Klug. He's the mayor of Williston, North Dakota. His town had been booming thanks to oil production. But by January of 2015, the price of oil had started to fall. And suddenly, Mayor Klug faced questions about whether the town could pay back hundreds of millions of dollars in debt it had used to build up roads and infrastructure to accommodate the growth.
I'm optimistic that the oil prices are going to go back up. There's only so much oil out there right now, and as long as it doesn't stay down for a long period of time, we should be just fine out here in Western North Dakota.
Well, it's been 2 years and oil prices have not recovered. People are moving away from Williston. So is Mayor Klug still feeling optimistic? I gave him a call on Friday afternoon.
Well, thanks for calling again, and thanks for wondering about Western North Dakota and Williston in particular.
Sure. So I'm curious, how are things going? Because the last time we spoke, oil was trading for about $47 a barrel. I just looked here today. It's somewhere below 46, so it hasn't gotten any better.
It hasn't in that case, but with technology changes and stuff like that, I just saw the other day that in the sweet spots of the Bakken, we're looking at producing oil from $18 to $22 a barrel, so there's money to be made out here once we get a pipeline or two in place so we can transport it and our oil isn't discounted so heavily. We should see an increase in the exploration and the completion of a lot of wells that are sitting out there waiting to be fracked.
What does that do for the mood of your town, though? I'm reading that storefronts have started to close. Earlier this year in April, United Airlines ended its direct flight from Williston to Houston. Moody's has downgraded Williston's debt to junk status. I mean, how are people feeling there, though? I know you're optimistic. That's your job. You're the mayor. But what is the feeling there on the ground?
People are telling me that they're looking at a Williston that they grew up in. The newcomers are saying, you know, we're still optimistic. I realize that we did lose a flight to Houston, but the rest of our flights coming and going, the numbers are good there. Storefronts closing, don't know exactly which one you're talking about there, but we...
I'm seeing that a Home Depot closed, a rent-to-own shop as well.
Okay, yeah, that is correct. The Home Depot was actually a satellite store out of Minot, North Dakota. The Menards here is pretty strong, though. They're in the same kind of business as the Home Depot was. So there is some optimistic people, especially now that the labor market is available here. We have quite a few people that were working in the oil patch or in some other industry, and now they've moved back into the retail, so you can actually find some people to make your retail business work. And that's working out pretty well for us here in Williston, because now when you go into the store, the lines aren't as long. And then get back to where you were talking about the bond ratings. Yes, are we concerned about that? Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned before that you had $300 million in debt. I don't know what that number stands at today, but if you don't have these oil revenues coming in, how are you going to pay for it?
Well, the oil revenues are still there. We're still producing, it just dropped a little bit more, but 900,000 barrels of oil each month. And those dollars are still going into the state. Now, the state of North Dakota has got to make sure that that they return the money to us out here so we can pay off these debts.
Well, the state of North Dakota was a big fan of Donald Trump He got 64% of the vote there in your state. And, of course, Donald Trump has said all along, all through his campaign, that he was going to help rejuvenate areas like yours. I believe he came to North Dakota, talked about oil and gas development. What do people there in Williston hope Donald Trump can do for them?
You know, just last night I went to the API banquet, American Petroleum Institute banquet, and the mood there was upbeat. I mean, they were wearing Donald Trump hats. They were excited about what the election brought to us. There was PowerPoint presentations of some of the regulations that they believe that will go away. Under the Trump administration. Wide sweeping changes they believe are going to happen so that we can develop the energy that we have out here in western North Dakota and be competitive with the rest of the world, not only be energy independent, but also an exporting nation once again.
But how much does regulation have to do with it? There is an oversupply of oil on the market across the globe. There's not much, tell me if I'm wrong, that looser regulations can do to get rid of that, is there?
Oh, absolutely. It won't take the oil off the market, but it'll make our oil more competitive for the rest of the world. So if we can produce oil at the same cost as Saudi Arabia and get that oil to the markets, it'll be a supply and demand thing, but at least we'll be in the right area to be competitive there.
Howard Klug is the mayor of Williston, North Dakota. Thanks again for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much for calling.
You heard Mayor Klug say Williston needs more pipelines to get the oil out of North Dakota. Well, that's exactly what's been driving the ongoing protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Late last night, with temperatures dropping into the 20s, protesters say police shot water cannons and rubber bullets into a crowd of about 400 people trying to cross a barricade. At least 17 people were taken to the hospital. For their part, police say protesters assaulted them with rocks and burning logs. In another story we're following today, climate scientists are alarmed to see unseasonably warm temperatures in the Arctic. Temperatures over much of the Arctic are more than 30 degrees warmer than usual. Craig George works in the Department of Wildlife Management for the North Slope Borough in Barrow, Alaska. That's on the Arctic Ocean, and I asked him what he's been seeing.
Well, I've been here 39 years, actually, and this is far and away the warmest fall I've experienced. Freeze-up was late. Snow was very, very late, and the sun is now down as of the 18th of November, and there's still no sea ice, which is pretty unusual.
Jennifer Francis is an atmospheric scientist at Rutgers University, and she joins us now via Skype. And Professor Francis, Craig George says there's still no sea ice where he is in Barrow. Does your data back that up?
It absolutely backs that up. There are many areas around the Arctic where there's no sea ice right now where there should be. And we're seeing record low sea ice for this time of year. And that's been the story pretty much all of 2016. Almost every single month this year so far, we've had less sea ice than we've ever seen over the record that we have.
Craig George was telling me that it was very strange because the temperatures were in the low 30s, which for this time of year is actually not good, because we're now in the middle of polar night. The sun is down for several months now. What do temperatures like that mean? And if there is no sea ice, what does that mean for the Arctic?
It means a lot of things. For one thing, we know that when it's very, very warm in the Arctic relative to the areas farther south, this tends to make the jet stream take a much wavier path as it travels around the northern hemisphere. So the jet stream is this river of wind high over our heads that creates the weather that we experience down here on the surface. And the reason those big waves are important is for a couple of reasons. One, they're helping keep the Arctic warm. When we get one of these big northward swings in the jet stream, it carries a lot of heat and moisture with it up far north. So that tends to exacerbate the problem. It tends to prolong and increase that warmth up there. So that's, you know, part of the story of why we just can't seem to get the ice to form this year. But the other reason that's important that we have this wavier jet stream is that when those waves get large, they tend to kind of stay in the same place for a long time. And that's important because those waves in the jet stream are what create the weather that we experience down here on the surface.
I was just going to say, what for those of us who don't live in the Arctic Circle, how does that trickle down to us?
Exactly. Well, this is one of the reasons when those waves get really big, it makes the weather patterns that we're experiencing tend to hang around for a really long time. I was just talking to someone in England just this morning, and he was saying that they've been stuck in this very stormy, cold, nasty pattern for what seems like forever. So we're seeing this very wavy pattern all across North America, across the Atlantic, and most of Europe as well.
So that's the short term. I wonder about long term, though. Mother Jones magazine, of course, leans pretty far to the left, says that the North Pole is in a death spiral. But some might wonder if you can just reverse what looks like is already an ongoing trend once it gets started. I mean, once that sea ice isn't there, is it a cycle that just builds upon itself?
Well, it would certainly tend to go that way because not only is the sea ice not covering as much real estate as it should at this time of year, but it's also extremely thin. And when that ice gets thin and it doesn't cover much ocean, a lot of extra heat from the ocean can get transferred into the atmosphere, which keeps the air warm. So again, it's kind of a vicious cycle that we have going here. And when we see this very dramatic warming and ice loss, then it's going to be hard to reverse it in this winter, I think. We're looking at a warm winter, probably for the whole winter up there in the Arctic.
Okay. Professor Jennifer Francis is an atmospheric scientist at Rutgers. Professor Francis, thank you.
Anytime.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Cyber Monday, next Monday, may start a few days earlier, this Friday, Black Friday. That's when Walmart is starting its Cyber Week deals rather than wait for Saturday as it did last year. Macy's is also kicking off its Black Friday sales at 5 p.m. on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. So does Black Friday matter? Jill Schlesinger has thought about it. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So Black Friday, typically a time for in-store deals and some of them, you know, crazy people lining up, well, the day before. Do you think more stores are going to follow Walmart and offer their cyber deals on Friday?
I think everything is starting sooner. You may start to get the feeling that holiday season is starting in August, but it actually does start hours after Halloween ends. That is because retailers have recognized that, in fact, all of November and all of December is what constitutes the holiday season, and they want us to start paying attention and almost like training us to believe we are in the midst of the holidays.
Right. Well, but people, we're still having Thanksgiving. And is it worth it on Black Friday? The New York Times had a piece last week that started, "Attention holiday shoppers, the overwhelming majority of Black Friday deals are duds."
Yeah, and you know what's fascinating is they had teamed up and do some analysis on this at the Times, and what they found was that Black Friday weekend is not so much about giving you, the consumer, a great deal. I know that, you know, we're very jaded about this. We understand that. But what it does is it actually creates a period of time where retailers can clear out their unwanted goods. And frankly, they don't put their best-selling products on massive cuts. They actually say, like, let's get rid of the grills and the fire pits because we don't need those taking up space.
And they know someone will take them. Well, so what do you recommend? You say if you're planning on shopping on Black Friday, use some websites, Price Grabber, Price Jump.
Yeah, I mean, start actually with just making sure you have a little bit of a budgeting app like Santa's Bag or maybe the Christmas gift list. If you're Jewish, they just pretend it says Hanukkah gift list. Okay, relax. Now, once you've got your list, you're going to track your pricing on Google. And yes, Price Grabber, Price Jump. There's also a cool site called Poach It. It tracks your desired products and then it alerts you when they go on sale. I guess what I'm saying is, retailers have been really smart about using algorithms and technology to target us. It's a time to turn the tables on them and go in armed with some information.
Wow, so you put your Christmas list in and then the app tracks the pricing for you.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And you say you should also go online at different times depending on what you plan to buy?
Okay, here's the deal. If you want electronics, don't actually wait till Cyber Monday. Evidently, according to retail analysts, today's the day to buy electronics. Ugh. You're ready for your next one. If you want apparel, get ready for tomorrow. Everyone says Wednesday's kind of a weird day. Thursday, oddly enough, even though it's a real bummer to actually buy jewelry in the holiday season, it's a total ripoff. If you're going to do it at all, evidently, Thanksgiving Day is good for jewelry. Black Friday deals, guess what? You might forget about your video games and your DVDs. Go buy a new car, because everyone says to me that car dealers want to get cars off their lots on that Friday. Cyber Monday, I know we talk about it for toys. That's a good time to do it, but not your really hot toys. You are not going to find your beautiful Barbie or your Frozen toy. It's just not going on sale this season.
All right. Well, you could do what REI is doing. They still have the hashtag opt outside, and they're saying, don't buy anything. We're closing on Friday to let our people go outside and play. You do it, too.
I'm in. I'm signed up right now.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Monday. Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
And to you as well.
Butter has a history that goes back thousands of years. And as we move into the holiday cooking season, let's learn more. Food writer Elaine Kosrova has traveled the world researching her new book, Butter, A Rich History. Elaine, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for your interest.
Sure. And how in the world did you come to write a book, an entire book, about butter?
Yeah, that's a good question, considering for most of my life and my career as a food writer, I took butter completely for granted. Of course, I had it in my refrigerator, and I cooked with it, and I baked with it, but I really never gave it much attention. Then one day, I had to actually do a butter tasting with about 12 different butters, and I remember sitting down to this table of tastings and being astonished by the differences in color, in texture, in flavor, aroma. I was really surprised, and I had no way of accounting for why they were so different. I mean, I knew that butter was made from taking cream and churning it. So essentially, you had one ingredient, and yet you had all this variation. So I was really surprised and intrigued.
So it's not as mundane as we think it is. And reading your book, I was fascinated by this idea that I think you seem to be in awe of as well, that butter comes from a cow, which has this lazy life, sort of eating grass and other plants that are not exactly teeming with fat, and yet cows produce this rich, fatty milk that yields the cream, which eventually becomes butter. It's almost magic.
Yeah, I talk about this Rumpelstiltskin kind of effect inside the cows. But I have to say, Peter, it's also in other ruminants. There are many other animals that can give us milk fat that we can make butter from. The water buffalo, the yak, goat, sheep. Reindeer. You can have reindeer butter. I mean, it's very uncommon, but the Laplanders back in the 19th century used to make reindeer butter simply by putting a little bit of their milk in a bowl, and the women would whisk it with their bare hands because, of course, it's very cold there.
And butter is ancient. I mean, that kind of proves the point that butter goes way back, all the way to very early humans. What do we know about its history?
It's likely that, similar to domestication of animals, you know, it happened in different places at different times. It's not like it happened in one place and then spread out from there. But we know that, for instance, the ancient Sumerians who lived 2500 BC, they were making butter. They have temple carvings showing churning and showing the cows. So that's thousands of years ago. It has a very long history.
And it was probably accidental the way it was discovered.
Most likely. The theory is that the milk ended up in a container, probably an animal skin, because back in the day, that's how people transported milk. And it got bumped on, you know, some road along the way, some traveling that the shepherd was doing. Mm-hmm. And through that, it was essentially churned, because agitation is what you need to make butter. We call it churning, but any kind of agitation will make butter.
So a happy surprise. Do you think it tastes today much the way it did so many centuries ago?
No, I doubt that it does. I think it was a much more fermented product then, without sanitation, without refrigeration. Everything was raw, for instance. And so the flavors of, you know, lactic bacteria would develop quickly, especially in those temperatures. So I think it was a much more funky product back in the day.
Huh. Well, it's also tied up in religion. It's mentioned in the book of Genesis. Tibetan monks are known for these sacred sculptures that they make with butter. You mentioned that there have been carvings of it found in ancient temples. What is the link between butter and divinity?
What we can surmise is that butter was really a sort of magical food. It was valuable and it was, they used it every day, but they really never understood how it was created. Why is it that milk that's liquid and white can suddenly yield these, you know, delicious, rich, golden pieces of fat? You know, how could that happen? It's a little bit like pearls and oysters or rainbows happening. You know, there's no real explanation until you can tease the science apart. So it had this quality that was somewhat magical, and it was also very valuable. So I think it was that combination that gave butter its kind of metaphysical role.
Huh. And you, your favorite is water buffalo butter from India.
Oh, I don't want to say favorite,
okay,
actually.
Okay, but I mean, high on the list.
High on the list was this one particular water buffalo butter that I had in India in a small, tiny village made by a woman who took the whole milk and fermented it, made it like a rich, delicious yogurt, and then she churned that, and it was outstanding. But I love French butter. There's some great American butters. There is, it's such a good time to be a butter lover. There's so many good choices out there.
Elaine Kosrova's book is Butter, A Rich History. And Elaine, the last quarter of your book is full of recipes that celebrate butter. Why don't you just give us your favorite, and we'll link to it at hereandnow.org.
Well, I love pie, and I love a good, tender, buttery crust. And since, you know, the holidays are coming, pie season, yeah, I would put that up there. But there's some really nice sort of comfort food recipes, great pound cake, things like that. Classic butter things.
Great. Elaine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A king was dethroned over the weekend. It did not happen in Europe or in a foreign country. It happened in Indiana. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports.
Edward Cheserek has just about always lived up to his Twitter handle, King Cheserek. During his incredible career as a runner for the University of Oregon, this Kenyan native has won 13 collegiate championships. But the one that would have truly placed him in the record books slipped away Saturday afternoon.
Disappointing right now.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing because, you know, this is my last year and it's a good race. Everybody was tough over there.
The race was a grueling 6.2-mile trek across the rolling fields east of Terre Haute, the NCAA cross-country championships. Cheserek was the overwhelming favorite going into the race, and a win would have made him the only man ever to take the individual title four times. But a familiar rival had other ideas.
The 2016 NCAA champion from Villanova, Patrick Tiernan!
Patrick Tiernan, an Australian who ran 5,000 meters on the track in the Rio Olympics this summer, took control of this race on the turf with a little over a mile to go and won it easily as Cheserek slipped to third. This was Tiernan's final college race, and the victory was sweet. It helped him erase the memory of last year's championship, which Tiernan lost to the seemingly unbeatable Cheserek. It was Villanova's first win in the individual race since 1963.
Just coming into it with the mentality that I wasn't coming second again, you know. Came second last year, and as good as it was, you always want to go one better. So,
Tiernan's coach is Marcus O'Sullivan, who knows a thing or two about this sport. From Ireland, O'Sullivan used to be a world-class runner himself. He won two NCAA titles for Villanova.
I love this race because it's just, it's open to anybody, and I'm just proud of him. I think he's just a great individual, and he was so believed in himself. Like, he really believed he could do this. So, and that's a testament to his mental and his mindset.
The day before these races, it was 72 degrees in Terre Haute, Indiana, but the temperature plunged into the 30s on Saturday, and the runners also had to endure howling winds that gusted well over 20 miles per hour. The tough conditions didn't seem to bother Missouri's Carissa Schweitzer. In a big upset, she swept past the leaders in the final meters to win the women's individual race. Besides the individual races, team national championships were also on the line this weekend. Northern Arizona easily won the men's title, but the women's race was just about as close as it could be. Oregon beat Michigan by just 1 point, an outcome that wasn't decided until officials reviewed the video. The Ducks coach is Marisa Powell.
It feels pretty great. I mean, before we saw the score, before we saw anything, I was blown away by their composure and just how well they ran today. So before we even tallied anything up, it was a huge success.
Cross country is a little bit like golf. The lowest score wins. In the team competition, the points are added up based on the places the five runners finish in. First place is good for 1 point, second is good for 2 points, and so on. On Saturday, the margin between Oregon and Michigan came down to 64th and 65th place. An Oregon runner got 64th, a Michigan runner was just a tenth of a second behind in 65th. And that one place difference was enough to give the Oregon Ducks the team title, the fourth in the school's history. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Many cities have a rat problem. Besides freaking most people out, the rats also devour food supplies and contaminate what they don't eat. They spread harmful viruses and bacteria, and they can eat through almost any obstacle in pursuit of a meal or a safe place to nest and breed. Seattle ranks high on the list of cities with a big rat problem. Homes there are more than twice as likely to report rat sightings than the national average. Ashley Ahern from KUOW tells us why Seattle has so many rats and how the city's trying to control them. And this warning, some people may find her story upsetting.
Meet Adam Truitt, age 37, occupation, rat killer extraordinaire. Truitt started his company, Pest Fighter, 8 years ago. He takes on all kinds of icky creatures, from yellow jackets to bedbugs. But most people call him about rats.
It's been absolutely crazy lately. Like, just today I got like 10 calls.
About rats?
Just for rats alone. Yeah, just today. And that's one, you know, one business in Seattle, you know?
There are several reasons Seattle has a lot of rats. But top of the list is us and the trash we create. So if you want to find rats, head for your nearest garbage-strewn alleyway. And there are hundreds of them in Seattle.
I mean, it's like a buffet for the rodents, basically. And it's all over town. I mean, all you got to do is drive around at 9:30 at night and you can see rats running everywhere. Kind of like a bicycle pump, huh?
Okay. There are so many rats here that Adam says it's more efficient to shoot them with a BB gun than to trap them. That might sound cruel, but I talked to the King County Department of Health, and officials there told me a pellet gun brings a quicker death than a slow poisoning. And it would take a lot of poison to kill all the rats in this alley.
I've already got about 45 of these out of here, so there's a lot less than there used to be. So I don't know how many we're going to actually get today, but...
If you want to talk rats, where else do you call but New York City? A place known for the size and aggressiveness of its rats. The first rat infestation was documented here in the 1750s.
Hello?
Hey, Jason?
Yeah,
how
you doing?
Good, how are you?
All right.
Good. Jason Munchie South studies the genetics of Manhattan rats at Fordham University, which means he traps rats all over the city.
We've trapped a rat that was well over 600 grams, you know, which is, you know, getting over a pound.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it was quite a monster.
That was a Norway rat, the same kind we have in Seattle. And Seattle, like New York, is booming right now. Tens of thousands of people are moving to the area every year, which means more trash to feed the rats. But it also means more construction. Old houses or rundown abandoned properties are popular rat hangouts. And when those buildings are torn down, Jason says you'll see a rat exodus. And they'll try to colonize other homes in the neighborhood.
It can be difficult because it only takes one property on a neighborhood scale to be the source or reservoir of rats.
A reservoir of rats. Okay, on to our last reason for the rise of rats. Climate change. During the cold winter months, rats take a break from making babies, and they just try to survive. And a lot of them don't make it. But Jason said last winter was mild in New York, and he was seeing rats not only surviving, but breeding in late December.
So when the spring rolls around, you're already going to have a lot of rats, and then they're just going to reproduce even more. So it makes it harder to control their population when it's warmer.
That explanation definitely rings true for what Adam Truitt, our rat killer, is seeing in Seattle. He told me a longer warm season is a big problem because rats are really good at breeding. A female rat can give birth every 3 weeks.
And they can be pregnant the next day. And they usually have about 6 to 9 babies.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's why they can breed so fast. They say they can have up to 150 descendants a year, which is a lot.
I follow Adam up the alley.
See, they're coming from this building right here on the right. See, there's a hole right there on the right-hand side behind this dumpster. Uh-huh. And they're coming and going from that hole.
Adam clutches his pellet gun and gets down on his hands and knees. His headlight beams into the dark crevices under the dumpsters. The whole place reeks.
Oh, we got one coming. Ah. Oh, he's coming towards you.
Oh, there's one right there.
Ah! Do you think you got him?
I must have. He's not moving in there anymore.
It's getting late, and we've only seen a handful of rats.
But, I mean, this is good because there's not a lot of them running around. I mean, when we first got here, they were everywhere. I mean, every time I turned my head, there was another one. Bam, bam, bam. And now it seems like there's the same, you know, three or four running around.
Truett packs up his pellet gun and heads back to his truck. He says the best way to keep rats out of your house is to seal up all the holes, even the little ones. A full-grown rat can squeeze through a hole the size of a quarter. And keep your compost covered and your trash tidy and out of reach of rodents. But between climate change, construction, and more people and trash, Seattle's future looks ratty. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern in Seattle.
And Ashley's story was produced for KUOW's Local Wonder. And one note, Peter, she mentioned Department of Health officials telling her the BB gun was more humane than poison. Hmm. Well, may we add, it's safer. Rest in peace, George the Cocker Spaniel, who got into someone's rat poison in a garage. Oh. And Ruby the Red-Tailed Hawk, very famous in the Boston area, probably nabbed a poison rat and then succumbed herself. I know, a bummer of a closer, but something to think about. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.